Good morning. We'll call the meeting of the Cultural Diversity Committee to order. Good morning. We'll call the meeting of the Cultural Diversity Committee to order. If we could get a roll call, please.
Chair Lieberman?
Present.
Vice Chair Perkins? Regent Carter? Regent Carvalho?
Here.
Regent McAdoo?
Here.
Regent Moran, you have a quorum present.
Thank you. We will move into approval of minutes. Is there a motion?
I'll move.
There's been a motion and a second to approve the minutes. Any discussion? Seeing none, all in favor?
Aye.
Okay. I'm sorry, we'll move back into public comment. Is there any public comment in Elko? Any public comment in Elko? Hearing none, any public comment in Reno?
There's none here in Reno.
Thank you. Any public comment here in Las Vegas?
Good morning, Amy Avaluna, Nevada State College, co-chair of the NSHE All Access Committee, which serves undocumented students. Yesterday, the President's Alliance on Higher Education and Immigration issued a statement to address five common questions by campuses, students, and staff on the potential impact of a Supreme Court decision on deferred action for childhood arrivals, including employment actions and access to higher education. Since I was coming here today to support my EDIT colleagues, I thought I would seize a moment and offer a brief public service announcement by highlighting two of the items discussed in that statement. I would be happy to email all of you the statement, along with more information about NSHE's All Access Committee. Considering the measurable impact the repeal of DACA would have on retention rates, not to mention the psychosocial and emotional distress it causes our students and employees, it is behooves us to ask, what will happen to pending applications and our documented students if the Supreme Court issues a negative decision? Sometime between January and the end of June 2020, the Supreme Court will issue a decision on whether the administration can legally end DACA. If they do end DACA, the worst possible outcome is that the administration will deny all pending applications and retract all existing DACA grants. We have over 13,000 college-age DACA recipients in Nevada. Our free legal resources offered on campuses are vital. What employment options will DACA recipients have if their DACA expires or is terminated? In summary, the answer to that is that NSHE needs human resources and programs to create inclusive fellowships and alternative options for documented and undocumented students so that they can earn money and afford to stay in college. The mission of the NSHE All Access Committee, of which I am chair with Mariana Sarmiento of UNLV, and we have members at every institution in the state, and we meet monthly at the NSHE offices, is to build a comprehensive statewide support system for students who are undocumented or who have DACA, as well as immigrant students under other statuses such as TPS. In order to increase our recruitment, retention, and graduation rates, the NSHE All Access Committee works to implement practical, research-informed, institutionalized, and systemic policies, and to provide tangible resources and on-campus support. By sharing information and through the great collaborative relationships we've built here in NSHE, we're able to guide best practices, impact equity, and intervene when necessary to advocate for student needs. We are proud to work with EDIC, this board, and NSHE staff to keep Nevada at the forefront of best practices on this difficult and ever-changing topic. We thank you, Chancellor Riley, for hosting our students at a roundtable earlier this month and later this year in the North, and including their input in the development of solutions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any other public comment in Las Vegas?
Hi, good morning. My name is Ashley Ewell. I'm the interim director for the UNLV Jean Neidich Women's Center here on campus. For those who may not be familiar with our services, our center provides free and confidential support services to members of the UNLV community who've been impacted by sexual assault, relationship abuse, family abuse, and/or stalking. We've been providing these services through our care advocates on UNLV's campus for about 11 years, and our programs and services, although we're called the Women's Center, are available to people of all identities and regardless of status. So through our services, the UNLV community can receive individual support to assist them through the process of making decisions around their experience, accessing support, such as emotional support or financial support, also working through feelings and exploring the impact and meaning of their experience with violence. So the decision to receive support services is often made while dealing with really challenging circumstances. Our hope of our office is to make getting started easier for the UNLV community. I'm here today in light of the recent Las Vegas Review Journal article regarding an increase in interpersonal violence, which encompasses dating violence, sexual violence, and stalking. The increase in crime reports. And I wanted to share and elaborate on some of the points that were made in the article. So, according to National Sexual Violence Resource Center statistics, we know that more than 90% of sexual assault victims on college campuses do not report the assault to law enforcement or to any other office in this institution. So, similar to what the article had stated, while an increase in clery numbers is very concerning, because, of course, acts of violence on our campus are concerning, it's important to remember that most violence that our students are experiencing goes unreported to any of our offices. So, when we see an increase in reports, this also demonstrates an increase in our victim survivors accessing our services and approaching our institutional offices for support. Just to elaborate a little bit more on the services our office provides and how we work to provide services and education to the campus, this past fall semester, so fall 2019, our office has seen a significant increase in students wanting to report to University Police Services, the Title IX office, and the Office of Student Conduct, which really hasn't been the case in the past. We believe that this is due to the institution's awareness of what's happening and also wanting to put more emphasis on providing services. Specifically, Police Services has created a SART team, which is Sexual Assault Response Team. And with that team, our office has been able to create a strong and trusting relationship with Police Services. So I know that my time is up, and I'm more than happy to provide additional information to any of you. Again, my name is Ashley Yule, and I thank you all so much for this time.
Thank you very much, and thank you for the important work of the center. Any other public comment? Thank you very much. We'll move out of public comment. I've been asked by legal counsel that we reconsider the minutes that were approved before public comment, because they need to be approved after public comment. So if we could get a motion again, I appreciate it.
I will move.
There's been a motion and a second. Any discussion? If not, all in favor? Aye. Any opposed or abstentions? Motion passes. Thank you very much. My chair's report is very, very short because we have a plethora of diverse issues to discuss today, but I want to thank the people that have done the work in the background to make this agenda possible, and also I want to acknowledge the work that is happening very productively with the Foster Youth Program and that student engagement that's going on around the foster community. And I want to especially thank the Walter S. Johnson Foundation for helping us to build a long-term relationship, which the board is totally supportive of, and we will discuss later in the full meeting agenda. So we will now move on to item 4, State of Higher Education, NSC, Dr. Fernandez.
Good morning. For the record, Edith Fernandez, Nevada State College. Just checking for the slide advance. All right. I will start. Happy to kick off a report that will highlight exciting 3 days of activity. On October 2nd, Nevada State College had the honor of kicking off a series of system-wide forums focused on diversity and the state of higher education. Virginia Congressman and current chairman of the U.S. House Committee on Education and Labor, Bobby Scott, was our featured keynote speaker. It was the first time a sitting chairman visited the Nevada State campus, and it was a great honor, for Congressman Scott is well known for advancing a national agenda focused on improving equity in education, which is in alignment with Nevada State's own mission. Congresswoman Susie Lee, whose district includes Nevada State, was also an integral part of this event, and she also serves on the U.S. House Committee on Education and Labor. Both Scott and Lee emphasized that a college education is still the key to opportunity, and their message resonated with our first-generation diverse student body who enters higher education balancing the demands of work, school, and family obligations. Congresswoman Lee commented, "For decades, Pell Grants have been a cornerstone of higher education system, making college more affordable for millions of Americans. However, not indexing Pell Grants to inflation has made this vital resource less and less valuable with each passing year. It's exciting to announce that within a week of this event, Congresswoman Lee introduced the Pell Grant Sustainability Act. The bill would make sure that federal resources for college students keep up with current costs by indexing Pell Grants to inflation. For the thousands of students at Nevada State, including those that attend part-time, the changes that Scott and Lee championed can positively impact the career trajectory of each student and forever change the socioeconomic trajectory of and mobility of their families. Nevada State set the tone for ENCHI's contribution to the national dialogue on the value of higher education and the promise a diverse and educated population holds. That was our first day. And second day, CSN.
Thank you very much, Dr. Fernandez. We'd like to move on to the item number 5, which is an overview of the Minority Summit that was held for the first time at the CSN campus. And Dr. Cota, if you would give us an update, please.
Thank you, Chair Lieberman. We are just waiting for the PowerPoint to be brought up. Thank you. For the record, my name is Clarissa Cota. I'm the Vice President Provost for the CSN North Las Vegas Campus, as well as the NCHSI Task Force. So good morning, Regents, Institutional Presidents, EDIC, and HSI Task Force members, NCHI colleagues. This morning, I am so proud to report on a very successful inaugural HSI-MSI symposium that was held on October 3rd, 2019 at the CSN North Las Vegas campus. This particular symposium was embedded with the importance of where our respective institutions are at with their HSI and MSI status and how we can leverage that in terms of our student success initiatives. And that was our overall goal. So I would like to thank all of you who were able to attend and all of you who were there in spirit to support such an event. Holding this event has been a goal of the NCHSI Task Force since its formation in 2014. We wanted to hold such an event for the benefit of not only our Nevada institutions, but our students as well, so that we could focus on our student success initiatives and how important it is to support this kind of work at our institutions. So I would like to thank this board, the Board of Regents, NCHI Chancellor Tom Riley and his staff, the HSI and EDIC team, institutional leadership from the presidents of our institutions, and our external partners, because we were successful in delivering a robust day-long program which featured national and local experts on HSI and MSI initiatives. We had representatives from the U.S. Department of Education, local and federal elected officials, NCHI students, and business and industry leaders, all collectively focused on our student success initiatives and the power of partnership. So first, we had to come up with the date. And as my colleague, Dr. Fernandez, had described, we had a robust three-day event. And so when we were planning for this event, and we wanted to focus it around the Southern Nevada Diversity Summit to make it easier on the travel for our northern institutions. So we were thinking about the October 3rd date. When Congressman Bobby Scott was unable to commit to the October 3rd date, we did not want to let go of that opportunity for him to come visit our Southern Nevada. And therefore, with our colleagues and their support, we were able to also feature Congressman Bobby Scott on October 2nd. So with that, October 3rd was set. The call to action for leveraging funding and student success theme was determined. And this robust program is part of your supplemental materials. So as we started to set the tone of what our intent was for the morning section, we wanted to emphasize the focus on our students. And so we involved the Nevada Student Alliance. Nicola Ofer, the chair of the NSA, had been our MC, and she did a fabulous job. She involved her peers. We had students participating from the north that traveled down with the UNR and TMCC. We also had all of our southern institutions represented as well with their students. Beginning the program, the beginning of it was designed to emphasize the diversity of our community. So we had Reverend Edward Cheney provide the invocation. There was a welcome provided by Chair Geddes, and as well as Chancellor Riley and Chair Lieberman of the CDC. We then had the UNLV Native American Student Association provide a land dedication. And then what followed was really the need to set the foundation for our audience, what HSI and MSI is all about. What is the foundation for it? So we were able to have a national expert, Dr. Andres Samoya from the Rutgers Centers for MSI, provide the overall national picture of why it is so important for Nevada to continue its work in elevating our HSI and MSI initiatives and where in terms we sit in the national scale. We then continued with Theo Meeks and myself providing a picture of where Nevada is. And so Theo Meeks was able to provide closing the achievement gap overview, and I was able to provide on behalf of the NCHI institutions what work we are doing at our respective institutions in terms of those types of initiatives and our data. The next panel was then to feature our Asian American Pacific Islander populations. This is a fast-growing population in Nevada, and so it was important to develop a panel around this important topic of why there is a need for system-level change to support this underserved population. We were able to draw a panel of national experts, starting with Dr. Robert Taranishi from UCLA, as well as Frederick Ngo from UNLV, and then Angela Sanchez from the ECMC. So that panel was able to blend both foundational knowledge and expertise as well as scholars from across the country. After that particular panel, we were able to serve lunch for our participants as well as have a very short reception in preparation for Congressman Joaquin Castro's presentation. Some of you were able to attend that lunch. Our students were able to interact with him. And he was able to speak to, as far as his new legislation called the HEAR Act, which is the Hispanic Education Resources and Empowerment Act. If passed, this would allow HSIs to have access to $150 million in grant money for increasing Hispanic and Latinx degree attainment. There's Congressman Castro with our students. So our program continued. We had a very special visit from the director, Beatriz Ceja. She leads the Title V program for the U.S. Department of Education. We were able to hear directly from them, and our institutions and our leaders were able to interact with her to hear specifically about what the components of this program are, the importance of also blending workforce and education in terms of our funding coming from the Title V. This panel was led by President Federico Zaragoza, as well as we had Dr. Andres Samoyes talking about how to collectively come together and what the best practices are. This was an amazing opportunity for all of our colleagues across to have this interaction right there in their backyard. We had Senator Jackie Rosen come and say a few words as well and address the importance and the support from her office she has for the work that we're doing at our institutions. And then this led for a very special opportunity to recognize the support and contribution from former U.S. Senator Harry Reid, and he was presented by an award on behalf of ENSHE by Tom Riley, and all of you were able to show your support and appreciation for his work. This was a really special occasion. We had an opportunity to collectively recognize his work as well as show him the support and appreciation we have for his contributions. The next panel was one of the more interesting blend of individuals that developed what was called the Civic Engagement Panel. On this panel, we were able to show and exemplify how important it is to blend our nonprofits along with our business industry partners together to collectively come together around student success and how we can leverage those partners and those relationships to really make an impact at our institutions. So we had Dr. Nancy Brune leading the particular panel. We had Dr. Cynthia Alcantar from UNR, who is a national expert on HSI initiatives, Tony Gladney, Vice President of Community Engagement for MGM, and we also had Laura Huerta-Migas travel from D.C., who is the Executive Director for the National Association of Children's Museums, which here in Las Vegas, the Discovery Museum is a member of them. So we were able also to include them in the symposium, and we had some other partners there as well. But it was a very spirited discussion, very interesting how we can be leveraging unique partnerships. As we continued, the last segment of the symposium was the importance of involving our federal elected officials. And so we were able to have a video message from the U.S. Senator Cortez Masto, and then we had a unique panel where we actually was able to coordinate their schedules, but had all three of our Southern representatives able to get into a discussion led by Chancellor Tom Riley, and we had Representative Horsford, Representative Susie Lee, Representative Dina Titus, all talking and recognizing the work that we are doing at our ENSHE institutions and the importance, and they could visualize, see the importance of their continued support for this. And then we added a little entertainment. We were able to give a sneak peek on our CSN Mariachi Plata group, and so they were able to play a few numbers for the group to not only wake everyone up, but also provide a very much needed entertainment. I wanted to also have all of you recognize our sponsors that were very supportive. We had MGM, Las Vegas Metro Chamber, the Latin Chamber, and the Tom Downs Consulting Group. So lastly, I just wanted to express the objectives that were met based on having this type of event. We were successful in elevating this particular discussion to both state and national level. I can tell you that, and most of, some of you may know, we have caught the attention of the national audience regarding HSI and MSI work. We also wanted to highlight the NSHE institutions related to the initiatives we have going and the leading to this improved student success. We provided a professional development for our colleagues. This has always been our goal, to bring information here so that our colleagues don't have to be traveling elsewhere. We want to be bringing it local and having it accessible to more of our colleagues. And we engaged local and national partners, showcasing the impact of these successful partnerships and networks. And we also engaged some of our other partners with NSHE, such as the Porter Group and Tom Downs Consulting, to help us do that as well. And our individual networks. This is where the NSHE-HSI Task Force works. We work together, and we leverage our own networks for the benefit of the whole. So next steps, what we're working on under the leadership of Chair Lieberman, we are planning for the HSI-MSI Symposium 2020. We are going to continue to debrief this particular symposium, engage in a continuous improvement process based on the feedback we have received. But we are definitely going to be continuing the momentum towards improved student success initiatives and partnerships. So in closing, again, I would like to thank the Board of Regents, the CDC Committee, the NSHE Chancellor and staff, the HSI Task Force, EDIC, Nevada, and our students, of course, the Nevada Student Alliance, CSN, and the NSHE institutions and presidents. Thank you. Any questions?
Thank you very much. And this is really a landmark beginning for us, and we will continue along this path in future programs and in future years. And we're very grateful for your leadership and the leadership of the committee.
Mr. Chair, if I may.
Dr. Oakes, if you can give us an update on the...
Mr. Chair, if I may, I was going to say that CSN really raised the bar with the Mariachi Plata performance, so they set the bar pretty high.
Dr. Oates, if you can give us an update on the really innovative and fabulous diversity summit that was held.
Gladly. Good morning to everyone here, Chair Lieberman, Chancellor Riley, all of the regents and our president. It's almost hard to believe that it was just 2 months ago that we were in this room with nearly 500 individuals celebrating our 8th annual Southern Nevada Diversity Summit. And UNLV was especially pleased to host this year. This is a difficult time in the field of diversity and inclusion in higher education, because there are so many challenges around free speech, acts of incivility, bias incidents, and the challenges of, you know, that we face as a system around access and success for all of our students, but also the really difficult work of making people feel that they belong when there are so many different people with so many different ideologies and beliefs within our college campuses. So it's, I think, like the work of our CDC committee and EDIC is even even more important, and that was especially highlighted at the Southern Nevada Diversity Summit this year. I wanted to show you some of the statistics around our attendance and who was there, because I think that it really just speaks to the hunger and the interest of people across our entire system. We had 591 individuals registered. That was a record. It really pretty much smashed the record from previous years. And just because of space limitations, we were only able to accommodate 440 people in this room, but we were able to provide live streaming of the keynote address and the fabulous president's panel so that people around the campuses and around the systems who were not physically able to attend could still participate. But in spite of that, we had a full house on that day. As you would expect, most of the participants came from UNLV, and that's common at all of our summits. Most of the participants come from the host institution, but you can see that at least 30 to 35% of the people also came from all of our systems, all of our institutions, and the larger community outside of UNLV. And we had representation from all eight of our institutions. So again, it just speaks to, I think, like the importance of having these kinds of annual events. And then when you look at the classification of the participants, it tells a great story. We only had 30 undergraduate students register. That's something that we all want to work on more in the future. But again, just like given the early response from our faculty and staff and community members, we really couldn't even get more students in. But we did arrange a number of the sessions so that students could come in even though they had not registered. And so that did allow for an increase in student participation. But our administrative faculty, graduate students, undergrads, classified staff, teaching and academic faculty, administrators, literally every level of people that work at our institutions were participants, in addition to nearly 50 members of the Las Vegas community. And again, I think that that was a record number of participants. We were also especially pleased this year to have such robust external sponsorship. MGM has always been a sponsor. They have been the only, you know, consistent external sponsor that we've had. But this year, we also had significant sponsorship from Southwest Gas and also from Cox Communication. And then Susie Smith, who is our director of development here, worked with a number of different restaurants, hotels, casinos, Turblehurst. I mean, like the giveaways were, phenomenal. So again, it was just showing the support for the work that we do. And so we were especially pleased to see the broad representation among the participants. And then another telling story was looking at the number of participants who had ever attended a diversity summit. So the majority of the participants had not attended one before. And I think that that's good because, see, you know, UNLV did not host the it has been 3 years since UNLV has hosted the Diversity Summit, so it's not then unusual to see such a large number of people attend the first time. But when you look at the chart or the pie chart on the right, you'll see that probably more than 70% of the people have attended anywhere from 1 to 3 of our summits. So people are traveling from school to school and participating, and we have a couple of diehard fans who had even who have attended 5, 6, or 7 of the 8 summits. So again, I think that these numbers are important to emphasize, because when you think about the fact that our 4 institutions totally fund this, The work is done by our small staffs and our, you know, the teams of volunteers that we get from the institutions. I think it's incredible that every year we're able to put on a summit of this magnitude, given the resources that we have, both physical resources and the financial resources. And then the last point that I wanted to make, just relative to the statistics, is looking at the race and ethnicity, because those of you who have ever talked to me know that I'm a very honest person about this work. And so I'm just going to go ahead and step out and make the statement that sometimes when we talk about the work of diversity and inclusion, people think that that's only related to minoritized communities. But you can see here that is not true. Most, the largest identity group of participants are white or Caucasian participants. So every race and ethnicity that's represented on our campuses also participated in the summit. And so again, I think it's important to emphasize that, because it's part of the work that we want to do to dispel the myth that diversity is only related to people from non-dominant identities. And that's clear here. I didn't put up the chart, but we also asked people if they were willing to identify their gender identity and sexual orientation. And again, we had a very broad spectrum of participants. And that just shows, too, just like the eagerness and the desire of people to be able to check the box that they feel truly represents their identities, and then to be able to learn more about it. And they appreciated our willingness to host events that would help educate other people how to show dignity and respect and to cultivate a culture of inclusion for people from those identities. So when, you know, for the day, we started out with a phenomenal keynote address by Ambassador Atala Shabazz, who talked very candidly about her life journey as the daughter of Malcolm X and Dr. Betty Shabazz, and the many phenomenal people that she'd met over the course of her life that shaped her ideas around diversity and inclusion. I think that she gave all of us some incredible insights about how to foster diversity and inclusion and the importance of it. And when I didn't think the morning could get any better, we followed that with a phenomenal conversation with our presidents of the four Southern Nevada institutions around the challenges of free speech. And, you know, you can hardly open your email these days, 2 or 3 days a week, without finding something where some university is dealing with some issue around free speech and the First Amendment, or the types of acts of incivility that impact our campus communities. So our presidents were very transparent, very honest. These are words that people shared with me afterwards, that they were very impressed by the thoughtfulness of our leadership. And I would just challenge us to try to think of providing some more opportunities for the people in our campus communities to hear from our leaders, because I wouldn't want to be in President Miana's shoes. Never. No way. Because when the heat comes, I mean, they're tossing balls at her left and right, 120 miles an hour. And I wouldn't want to be in that seat. And for those of you who also are, you know, share that seat with her, what I do know by working closely with her is how complicated these decisions are. And so one of the things that I felt was the greatest benefit of having that conversation with the presidents is that they were very honest about the complexities of making those decisions, and they cultivated a greater sense of empathy among the people who participated. So we really do need to think about how we can have those sorts of conversations with our students, because it seems so clear to them and so easy. Well, why didn't you just do this? And they don't know the 49,000 other decisions that have to be made. So that's some of what we're trying to do with our diversity summits, is to provide different sorts of sessions and so that we can teach people both like how to show dignity and respect, what that looks like, but also to give them an inside look at the challenges of being a person with a particular identity and of being a part of a community that really strives to embrace those communities. The last thing that I'll say is that after we broke for lunch, we had a number of breakout sessions, and people stayed with us for the whole day. And I'm not going to read the title of all of the sessions, but I did want to give you a little bit of insight into the kinds of sessions that we had. So, again, you can just see the scope of work that the diversity officers have to address on our respective campuses and the work that we gladly embrace in partnership with each other. So we had a session on cross-institutional capacity building to deal with racial inequities at minority-serving institutions. We had a session on first-generation students, implicit bias and microaggressions, enhancing graduate student diversity, emergency planning. Goodness knows we all need to learn more about that, right? Because when crises happen, you need to already have a plan in effect in advance. And working with individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities, LGBTQ equity and inclusion, developing a culture of educational equity. So some of the strategies that our faculties are doing in the classroom to foster equity, building a diverse teacher pipeline, crossover strategies for underrepresented students and faculty to foster their success, the digital divide and solutions for diverse campuses, pedagogy, third culture kids, undocumented students, marketing and how that impacts inclusion, communication and awareness with cross-cultural dialogues, men of color and their success, health professionals with disabilities, social justice issues within the field of sex work. Okay, I'd love to have sat in on that one. And then knowledge in the blood, the politics of politeness. So you can see, and then we had to turn down 40 presentations that were submitted because we just didn't have the time and space. So I'm a numbers person because I believe that there's power in numbers. And the fact that we had to turn away 40 different proposals just shows again that people are working on these issues. They want to talk about it. So we just want to also, again, just thank you for your continued support. But I will be so bold as to ask on behalf of my colleagues for an increased level of support from you all. I think it has been a great move that the CDC meetings have been moved so that all of the presidents and the regents could be here to hear the conversations, because the work that we do impacts everything that happens within these campus systems, and we cannot work in a vacuum. So again, I just want to thank you for your support. I just want to thank you and to reinforce that we are here as your partners in any kind of way, and just hope again that we can continue maybe in one of our future sessions having a conversation with the diversity officers and the presidents and how we sort of navigate those partnerships to foster a culture of inclusion on campus. So I will stop there and just ask if there are any questions.
Thank you very much. Before I give some comments, are there any questions from the board? Regent Perkins.
I know. I just want to say I did participate in part of the Diversity Summit. I wasn't able to stay for the full 2 days, 3 days, 2 days.
Can you speak a little louder?
Okay, but it was very interesting, and some of the things that I learned there, I actually took back into like my real life and real world, and they applied very easily, and the strategies that were given were amazing. So just wanted to make that comment. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
There are so many levels on which we have to thank you and the planning group. First of all, your pie chart today was very understandable and reasonable. Second of all, to bringing Dr. Shabazz to campus was a remarkable experience for those who were able to participate. Our President's Forum, their support of the summit and bringing their colleagues to UNLV and the presentation that they did was just remarkable. So I hope it's a continued foundation for what we have the ability to do now and in the future, and I thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, so we are moving to item number 7, handbook revision, information and communications technology for assistive technology. And we have this on the agenda as a possible action item. However, this is a work in progress. We are not ready for an action item yet, so we will only do it as informational at this point. And I'll turn it over to our Assistant General Counsel to introduce the item. Z.
Thank you, Chair Lieberman. Good morning, Regents, Presidents of the Universities. My name is Alalan Bulgala, the Deputy General Counsel for System Administration at the Nevada System of Higher Education. So with the rapid pace of technological change, it's been extremely important for us to maintain compliance with the Americans with Disabilities Act and the Rehabilitation Act of 1973. And so I was sort of tasked with coordinating the review of our policy, and I have done that with a task force comprised of members of all the institutions. And so I wanted to introduce the Technology Accessibility Coordinator of UNLV, Philip Voorhees. He's sort of the brainchild of all of this, and he's going to present some of the changes we are working on. We're still working on them now, and we intend to bring them back to the board at a later meeting.
So it's my understanding we might not have the revisions for the policy up. Hopefully that might happen. But thank you very much for this opportunity to speak with you and update. Thank you, Regent Lieberman, for helping me and the work group on identifying updates that are fairly needed. I'm going to keep this very short because I was told I only had 10 minutes anyway and you might have questions. So initially what I would like to do is talk about initial proposed revisions. These updates are mostly minimal and dealing with repetitive language, primarily dealing with the web content accessibility guidelines that are in the policy itself. Some of the changes also, though, deal with broader language of individual instead of specific language of student in addressing accessibility of ICTs, as it is our institutional responsibility to deal with all individuals with disabilities, not just our students. Create an off-policy standards document that will provide a better mechanism for us to be able to update those guidelines that are precedent developed through enforcement actions by the federal government, both in cases as well as OCR agreements. At this point, we are now out of date. In the policy, we have WCAG, or Web Content Accessibility Guidelines, 2.0 A and AA. Back in June of 2018, 2.1 was introduced to the community, and soon after, in November, the first application in a case of 2.1 A and AA to begin the precedent setting change over to 2.1. This document will allow us a better mechanism to be able to update when the guidelines update and when actual precedent suggests that we need to make that update. Most notably is to include and cover Title I of the ADA. At this point, the current document has split the state of Nevada in dealing with how we interpret the current policy. UNR is addressing the accessibility for Title I, Title II. We are basically dealing with public and student-facing materials and not taking into consideration Title I entities, which is basically our faculty and staff. So we're looking at eliminating one clause that then puts in that basic objection to providing access to our faculty and staff. All we need to do in order to address this issue is we're just literally eliminating one clause, and that's it. In the process of reconvening this new work group, and this new work group's a little bit different than the previous. The previous was really a whole lot of individuals from Disability Resources and a few others that were included that created the original policy. This work group is actually a convalescence of a whole lot of individuals in lots of different roles so they can get a better understanding and understanding of the impact of this policy as we work through it. I think that is a huge benefit because now we're talking about procurement and all those other components that come along with this. The other component to this is as we met this new work group, there were additional revisions that were beginning to come up. So beyond the original revisions, which are already in place in the document, so if you get a chance to read it, you will see the changes. But we are now having conversations specifically about a couple of other items. One of those being a clearer understanding of the word archive and what that represents in dealing with exceptions to the policy and how that applies. There's lots of different information provided to us in enforcement actions by the federal government. There is also, and let me get this correct. There is also a supplemental advance notice of proposed rulemaking that was shelved by the Department of Justice that has a plethora of information about how DOJ was going to look at possibly providing guidance in dealing with the word archive and exceptions. So we're now working through these to have this conversation within the work group. Beyond that, then there are other conversations about updating procurement language to reference an NSHE off-policy procedure that includes documents that we all can use that are consistent. And it would help in an initiative that we're dealing with SCS in providing a vetted ICT database that we all can feed information to. So if we're all following the same process and providing the same documentation, then it's just going to benefit the system that much more. So further things that we're looking at are inclusion maybe of a standardized, develop and include a language of accessibility training as well as language for resources, how we can begin to implement those processes. These are all conversations that have come up with different members of this work group. Actually, since I came to the Nevada system. So with that, that's where we are. And I would like to ask if you have any questions at this point.
Any questions from the board? Regent Carter.
Not really a question per se, but I just want to say, you know, thank you for the work. This came up as a compliance kind of revision idea, and I'm glad that we're running with it over here instead of over in my committee. But it's time to look at this and make sure that we are compliant with what we need to do and be helping to meet whatever regulations we need to meet. So thank you.
Great. Thank you.
And thank you for your ongoing work. And this has been a seamless collaboration between NSHE staff and the campus representatives, so I'm grateful for that, and we look forward to the update this spring. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Richard Lewin. Thank you, everybody. I appreciate it.
Moving on to item 8, several months ago, Regent DiCarlo and I, among others, were able to attend the State of the School presentation by Dr. Schwenk for the UNR Medical School. One of the persons highlighted there was Ryan Weebles, who is living with muscular dystrophy and at the same time doing landmark research on muscular dystrophy. And I wanted him to take a few minutes to talk about his life and his work and what we can expect with this dynamic area of research. So I welcome you, Dr. Weebles. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairman Lieberman. And thank you to the committee for allowing me to speak. Is there any way I could get the slides so I can see them? Or? Next slide. So I'm a research assistant professor. I work in pharmacology at UNR. And I'm not going to be able to read this very well. So I'm basically going to just tell you a little rundown of my life. Oh, perfect. Thank you. So I was extremely athletic as a kid. This is actually a very common theme with people that have my form of muscular dystrophy. You actually hear up till the age of 15, they excel at athletics. And then everything starts to go downhill. I was very good at soccer, basketball, baseball. I then moved to Illinois because my dad is actually a professor there as well. And, I still was able, even with the muscular dystrophy, able to play varsity soccer and basketball in high school in a fairly large school. So I moved on. I went to U of I, University of Illinois. And there I did a lot of weightlifting. And that's actually where the first person noticed that I had abnormally winging scapula. And so I went to the doctor to see what was wrong with me. And that's where I was diagnosed with muscular dystrophy, a form I'd never heard of, and most people have never heard of, called facioscapulohumeral muscular dystrophy, or FSHD for short. There's a lot of signs when I look back at the progression of the disease. I was actually born without a pectoralis major, which is very surprising because when I was weightlifting as a freshman and sophomore in college, I was able to bench press 200 pounds, and that's pretty surprising considering I was missing the major muscle that was actually responsible for lifting the weight. At the age of 13, I actually lost my ability to do a sit-up, lost my speed and jumping beginning in at age of 18 or 15. I had extreme hamstring weakness at the age of 18, couldn't even lift it off the ground. And like I said, the scapular winging is actually how I was diagnosed eventually. This has progressed significantly since then. I had difficulty walking upstairs at the age of 27, getting up from seats, having to push off with my arms at 29, and walking up slopes at 32. And now I've had trouble even with balance, and so I use what they call a Canadian crutch now to get around instead of using walls for balance. Next slide. Thank you. We can actually just go through this. So what is FSHD? FSHD is a slowly progressing muscular dystrophy. It can actually be very, very severe or very, very mild. There are children that actually are severely affected at very early ages. They end up being wheelchair bound in their teens or earlier, and they can actually have premature death due to problems that arise from respiratory function or other disease problems. So next slide. So it affects all races, all genders, the genders, everything equally. It's among the most prevalent forms. It's actually the third most common behind Duchenne's and Becker's. Next slide. It is estimated to affect around 1 in 10,000 to 1 in 8,333 people. Next slide. it's actually probably underdiagnosed due to the very mild forms that can occur later in, that are maybe diagnosed in their 50s, 60s, or 70s. It can look like aging in those patients. Next slide. As I said, equal frequency in both genders. Next slide. Most people, the most common form of FSHD have very, very noticeable muscle weakness in some aspect, either the face, the scapula, or the humerus by the age of 20. Next slide. As I said, it can the age of onset can vary, and it can be very early or very late. Next slide. And typically, the face, shoulders, and upper arms are what is initially noticed to be affected, and that's followed by foot drop and later leg weakness, such as I've talked about. Next slide. And around 20% of people, I personally use a scooter as well, but will be dependent on a wheelchair. I'm not actually wheelchair bound, but it helps when I'm doing a lot of walking, kind of like I did today. Next slide. And so there are some other extramuscular abnormalities that have been attributed to FSHD, such as hearing and eye abnormalities. Next slide. And so this is another muscular dystrophy, just like every other muscular dystrophy, of which there are actually 40 different genetic forms in which there is no cure. If you include myopathies, there's over 100 different forms of these diseases that can affect people. Next slide. So, as I've kind of gone through, the primarily affected muscles in FSHD, the chest, the abdominals, the humerus, face, and scapular muscles, along with the TA in for foot drop. It's caused by it's definitely the most complicated human disease that we currently know about. It's caused by a contraction in a non-coding repeat, or at least we thought it was non-coding until we found a toxic gene that resided in this repeat called D4Z4 on chromosome 4. I won't get too much into the science, but it is extremely complicated. This contraction in this repeat number leads to the ability of this gene to be expressed abnormally and leads to muscle death. Go ahead.
I hate to do this, but we need to start to wrap up because another meeting is coming into this room. If you could just close, I appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem. So essentially, I've been living with the disease. It is difficult to work in any profession, I believe. However, I think academia is a great place for people with muscular dystrophies. I've known quite a few actually that had FSHD that found homes in academia. However, there's still difficulties that arise with the ability to work and progress in our careers. So, thank you for the opportunity to talk.
Thank you very much, and thank you for your leadership and your life example. We'll move into item number 9, new business. Is there any new business for consideration by the committee at this time? If not, we'll move into public comment. Any public comment in Reno? Seeing none, any public comment? Is there a public comment in Reno?
Yes, there's no public comment.
Any public comment in Elko?
No public comment from Elko.
Any public comment here in Las Vegas? Seeing none, thank you very much, and this meeting is adjourned.